Hello, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy. I'm Tevi Troy, your host, and this week we're going to talk to Ben Shapiro, the author of Primetime Propaganda, the true Hollywood story of how the left took over your TV. Ben is a pretty interesting guy. He is a Harvard Law School graduate, also went to UCLA, was the youngest person ever to get a syndicated column in this country, and he decided to do some real research into what Hollywood executives think and what kind of political thoughts are going into the shows they put on your TV screen. He went around with his Harvard Law School hat. He's very young. He's got a Jewish last name. And all those things helped the Hollywood executives open up because they assumed that Ben shared their political perspectives. He did not. And the resulting mix of his political perspective and their assumption that he shared theirs has led to this book, Primetime Propaganda. So with that in mind, let's listen to the interview with Ben Shapiro. Ben Shapiro, welcome to New Books in Public Policy.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I know it's early out there on the West Coast, so I appreciate you getting up. And I'd like to start by asking you a little bit before we get into your book about who are you and how you came to write this book.
I'm a lawyer. I went to Harvard Law School. I started off, I grew up in Hollywood. I mean, the background for the book really is that I grew up in Hollywood. I spent my entire life there. Both my parents work in Hollywood. My mom does business affairs for reality TV shows, including Hell's Kitchen. My father does scoring for film and television. And, so I grew up, and my cousin, you know, who I grew up around the corner from, is the star of Matilda and Miracle on 34th Street. I mean, I grew up in the Hollywood milieu. I went to UCLA for undergrad, graduated from high school at age 16, so started there at 16. In my second year, I got very active on campus very quickly because when you're conservative, it's pretty clear in college that you can either become really active or really quiet. I chose the active route, and I started writing for the UCLA Daily Bruin. After about a year of that, I thought to myself, you know, is my stuff good enough to be syndicated? And I actually asked my father, do you think my stuff is good enough to be syndicated in normal newspapers? And he said, yeah, I do. And I emailed Creator Syndicate. I just sent my stuff off to Creator Syndicate, which is one of the bigger syndicates in the country, cold. About 3 weeks later, they called me and said, you know, would you want to be a syndicated by us? I said, absolutely. They didn't know how old I was at the time. I was 17, so I had to have my parents sign the contract. So I became a syndicated columnist at age 17. I then wrote my first book, which was about liberal bias on college campuses, and it was the first book that was really an inside look at college campuses because I was in the classroom. So I was quoting specific professors on specific days, talking about specific things, and really revealing what goes on inside the classroom. So that was very successful. Then I got into Harvard Law School, wrote a couple books while I was there. One of them was called Porn Generation, How Social Liberalism is Corrupting Our Future. And the other one was called Project President, Bad Hair and Botox on the Road to the White House. That one was more apolitical. In the mistaken belief that the market was going to be apolitical in 2008, because we'd been moving into this kind of postpartisan time. Of course, that was right before it came out right before the primaries. So the timing was probably a little unfortunate on that one, but the book did fine anyway. And then the latest book. So I'm a lawyer, I'm a writer, I'm an Orthodox Jew, I'm married about 3 years, and I have a significant Hollywood background, and that's kind of how the book came about in a way.
Yeah, that's amazing that you are so accomplished and you had a syndicated column at age 17. But when you read the book, it's pretty clear that you watch a lot of TV, too. So is this sort of vindication for TV-watching kids to know that they can get into Harvard Law School also?
Yeah, I don't think TV makes you stupid. I think that I think you can watch TV and do just fine. You also have to do your other work. Thank God I've been blessed a little bit that I can get my work done very quickly. So that leaves me a lot of time to do other things. And I mean, frankly, what are you going to do in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the middle of the winter when you're done with your work? I mean, it's not like you're going to go out and party it up. It's Cambridge, right? I mean, this is not exactly party central. Plus, I'm an Orthodox Jew, so what kind of partying could I really do? So, I watched a lot of TV while I was at Harvard, watched a lot of TV while I was at UCLA. I grew up on watching TV, and kind of my background in TV watching is that when I was really little, my dad made, certain specific choices as to what we could watch. So I grew up on classic TV, which is something most people don't. My dad would go out, and there's a very famous Hollywood kind of rental store called Eddie Brandt's, where they have every film and TV show known to man. And he would go out and he'd rent old episodes of Dick Van Dyke, and he'd go out and rent old episodes of Mary Tyler Moore and old episodes of Twilight Zone. So I grew up on kind of classic TV because his view was that I should only be watching classic TV for the most part, because classic TV was clean. The values of it were a lot better than the stuff that was on TV now. and he didn't want me watching stuff like cynical stuff like The Simpsons. And so that lasted until I was about 10, at which point I realized, wait a second, when Dad leaves the room, the remote's still here, so I can actually turn the channel. So at that point, I kind of started watching, you know, everything. I don't mean everything like I was, you know, turning on HBO to watch, you know, Sex Confessions, but I was you know, watching The Simpsons and the shows that all the other kids were watching. The truth is, I didn't really like those as much, the older shows for the most part. But, you know, some of them are pretty good and some of them are pretty well written. And so I started watching those. And about the time I was, you know, 14 or 15, I started to realize already, wait a second, you know, Dad is actually right here. These are promoting a certain value system. And that value system is not what I believe in, and it's pretty manipulative. And that didn't mean I stopped watching it. I still enjoyed it, but it kind of opened my eyes to what I was watching. And then, you know, when the book came about, one of the reasons that I wrote the book the way I did, and when I wrote Primetime Propaganda, what I really wanted to focus on substantially was what was going on behind the scenes, what was happening in the background of these shows. Because anybody can do a content analysis of the shows, and in fact, in my second book, Porn Generation, a lot of it is content analysis. A lot of it is looking at older shows and current shows like Friends, shows like Sex and the City, and saying, you know, what were they trying to get across with these shows and how do they impact society? With this book, I wanted to go further than that. I wanted to actually find out from the horse's mouth what the deal was, who was behind the shows, what was their background, what were they trying to do? And I think all of that's very important because to a certain extent, I'm kind of a legal realist. Which means that, you know, in the world of law, if you're a legal realist, that just means that you think that people's political views tend to come out in their interpretation of law. I think that's about 10 times more true in the world of art. I think that, you know, no matter what your background is, it's going to come out in your artistic work. The background of the people who makes the art that we all watch is really important to understanding what the art is actually trying to say to us and how they're trying to manipulate us. And I think that, you know, conservatives in particular need to understand that what happens with entertainment is so much more powerful than what happens with politics. I mean, this is something I think most conservatives fundamentally do not want to understand because down deep, I think a lot of conservatives are liars. I think a lot of conservatives want to say, you know, if you ask them what they watch, they'll say, you know, I watch old episodes of The Waltons. What do they actually watch? They're watching Glee just like everybody else. But if you ask them, you know, don't you think it has an impact on you to watch those kind of shows? They'll say, no, you know, I know that Hollywood is liberal and entertainment doesn't really matter. You know, I can keep my politics and my entertainment separate. Yeah, except you're being emotionally manipulated. That's what TV does. That's what entertainment is designed to do. It's designed. And did you? I don't know, Tevi. Did you see this? There was a study that came out like 2 days ago. That was on what is the most, scientifically speaking, what is the saddest movie in movie history? Like they did polling, they did studies, and I don't know if you saw this, but the saddest movie that they'd ever come up with was The Champ, the one with John Voight and Faye Dunaway. Yeah. And if you go back and you watch the scene that is, of course, the saddest scene where John Voight is lying dead on the table and the little kid is his son is weeping and running around, wake him up. You know at a certain level that you're being manipulated, right? I mean, it's very manipulative, but it's very successful in its manipulation. That's what people at Hollywood are really, really good at, manipulating you emotionally. And that has a tremendous impact because the fact is that conservatives, we like to think of ourselves as the reasonable folks, and liberals are the ones who use emotion. You know, we're the ones who are fact-based and reason-based. You hear this, you hear talk show hosts say this all the time. You know, we have the facts and the reason on our side. They only have the emotion. Okay, well, if that's the case, we're going to lose because emotion is substantially more powerful than fact-based rational logic. It takes a lot of rational logic to overcome just a little bit of emotion.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in that, in what you said there. First of all, I just have to say for the record that I thought the saddest movie ever is Life is Beautiful, the Benigni film, which is just a wonderful film. But you talk a little bit about your method. You don't really get into it in what you just said, but I'd like you to talk about it because there have been a lot of books by conservatives who've criticized Hollywood, and they've done content analysis, and Michael Medved is famous for this, and Judge Bork has criticized Hollywood and liberal values. But I think you're really the first book since Ben Stein in 1979 to really go and talk to the people who produce TV stuff and kind of get inside their heads about what they're thinking. And you said that you, I guess, had some tricks. I mean, the fact that you're Jewish, I'm Jewish as well, but and everybody in Hollywood seems to be Jewish. I mean, the fact that you were Jewish kind of disarmed people. The fact that you went to Harvard Law School disarmed people. I guess that you were young. I mean, did you kind of, if not consciously, but sort of subconsciously trick some of these people into thinking, oh, this person must think like me because they're Jewish and young and went to Harvard Law School?
Yeah, I mean, I think I allowed them to let their stereotypes play. I mean, I certainly didn't disillusion them about my political viewpoint. I mean, I didn't come in and say, look, I'm an ardent conservative and I'd love to interview you so I can bash you, right? I mean, that's not a really successful interview strategy for the most part. Plus, to me, it was kind of irrelevant because the truth is that if you read the book, what you have, I treat these people pretty fairly for the most part. You know, I'm pretty complimentary of them. I talk about how smart they are and how brilliant they are and what great artists they are. I just disagree with their politics and I try and kind of let them speak for themselves. I'm not quoting them out of context. I give them block quotes. You know, I give them a paragraph where they get to explain fully what they're trying to do. When I emailed them to set these interviews up, and by the way, it's very easy to get interviews with people if you email them. I emailed them and I would say, my name is Ben Shapiro. I'm a nationally syndicated columnist. My last book was Project President, which was endorsed by people ranging from Tim Gunn, right, of Project Runway, to Jim Hightower, which obviously implies that, I'm center to left. And then I said, I'm doing a book for HarperCollins about the history of television and the kind of symbiotic relationship between social change and what occurs on television. And I'm interviewing the biggest names in Hollywood to make this happen and profiling them and talking about their impact on the cultural debate. So there are a couple things there that I think the people resonated to when they wanted to do the interview. The first thing was the fact that I was calling him one of the biggest names in Hollywood, because there's one currency that works almost better than money in Hollywood, it's ego.
Ego stroking, yes.
Exactly. And all these people want to be known as the biggest names in Hollywood. And so, that appealed to them. The other thing was obviously, Shapiro, I said I was from Harvard Law School. I said I had a book contract with Harper. I said the way I phrased, what the book was about, which is really what the book is about. It is about the symbiotic relationship between Hollywood and social change in the country. But the way I phrased it, it sounds much more like a term paper for Yale than a mainstream kind of release. They probably felt, pretty safe in talking to me. They allowed me to, they allowed me in the room. And then when I asked them the questions, there were certain buzzwords that I would use to get them to give honest responses. So instead of asking them, are you for, what's your view on abortion and how does it come out in your film or your TV show? What I would say is, do you feel that it's important to have social justice messaging in your television shows, or are you simply driven by ratings? And of course, most of them are going to answer, no, of course we have social justice messaging. But that really is the honest answer, because then I would ask them a less kind of leading question, which is, what are the shows that you made that you think are most important? Which are the ones that are closest to your heart? And the vast majority of them were not, here's the most beautiful scene that I ever wrote. Most of them were, here's an episode that I did about AIDS. Here's an episode that I did about abortion. Here's an episode I did about gay marriage. And we thought that was particularly interesting. So, some people like Vin DeBona, who is the producer of America's Funniest Home Videos, and MacGyver, and he made the unfortunate mistake of having said to me on tape that he thought the discrimination against conservatives in Hollywood was actually a good thing. It was actually a positive, and he was happy about it. I released that tape, and Variety went to him and asked him about it. And what he said in response was, Shapiro deceived me. And what I said is, no, I really didn't. I mean, I didn't, it's not incumbent on me to make my politics clear to you. It wasn't a deception as much as you kind of just assuming that a simple Google search. Well, it's not like I've been an open conservative. Like I said, I've been a syndicated columnist for 10 years. You put my name into Google, you're going to come up with over a million hits of me being conservative. So it's not like I'm in the closet in any way. And this was a James O'Keefe kind of sting. I respect James, and a lot of the stuff James does is great. But the fact is, in California, it's a two-party consent state. So, in terms of taping. So I wanted to be upfront and honest with these people, at least insofar as having the tape recorder on the table, explaining to them what the interview is about, talking to them openly. What he was really complaining about was that if he had known I was a conservative, he would have answered the questions differently. He would have lied. And that, I think, is the real key here. I think that people on the left, this was a look behind the curtain at what they say in the privacy of their own rooms when they think they're talking to their friends.
You mentioned this Google test of yourself, this ability that if somebody would Google you, they would clearly find out that you're conservative. Now, this got you in trouble, or I don't know, trouble, but it lost you the potential for having an agent represent you and perhaps a career as a successful screenwriter. Can you tell that story and say what that indicated about Hollywood?
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. Basically, as I went on, when I started writing the book, I mean, it was so funny. People on the left, when the book came out, they tried to paint me as, some ideologically upset screenwriter, and so I wasn't able to get a job, so I decided to write a book criticizing Hollywood. Well, kind of the reverse. I decided to write a book, about Hollywood, and then I couldn't get a job. Meaning, I've never made a dollar from Hollywood, which is fine. I do just fine, as I said, I'm a lawyer. Up until 3 weeks ago, I was the vice president at Talk Radio Network, which was the syndicator for Michael Savage and Laura Ingraham. So I was doing just fine, and I still am because I quit to pursue other opportunities, and mainly related to this book. It was never an issue. Like, I need to be in Hollywood to make money. I went and I did these interviews. One of the people I interviewed was a guy named Leonard Goldberg. Leonard Goldberg is the producer of Blue Bloods on CBS. And Leonard is closet independent / conservative. He's certainly not a liberal. He and I kind of hit it off because he's one of the few pro-Israel Jews in Hollywood. Most of the Jews in Hollywood really don't give a damn about Israel. He really does. So he and I, you know, hit it off in a pretty substantial way. And he said, you know, why don't you tell me a few stories about how Harvard Law School was? I started telling him some kind of funny stories about what happened at Harvard Law. And, you know, at Harvard Law, it's not the paper chase anymore, but there's still elements of it. I mean, there's still some crazy things that happen. So I was telling him these stories, and he said, you know, why don't you write me a pilot based on your experiences at Harvard Law School? And so I said, okay, sure, that's, you know, he's Leonard Goldberg. I mean, for God's sake, the guy sits on the board of CBS, and the money in Hollywood is astonishing. If you have a network show and you are the writer of a network show, you're making $30,000 per episode, leaving aside the royalties, right? Leaving aside the residuals. If you write a full season of a show, there's a good chance you can make well over $1 million. So I said, sure, you know, I'm happy to write something. So I wrote something. And if you read the script, there's no way that you know I was conservative, because when I do fiction writing, I write what I want to be interesting plots. And so, you know, for example, in the pilot episode of this show, which was titled Harvard Law, it was based on my experience at Harvard Law. While I was there, the dean of the school was Dean Kagan, right? Elena Kagan, who's now in the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, everybody in the world in Cambridge knew that Dean Kagan was a lesbian. I mean, this was not even like a question, and nobody cared, right? Because who cares? And so her character was a lesbian, and I had her as a lesbian in the script. I treated that with you know, respect. I didn't say anything negative about it. And I have a couple characters in the show who are liberal. I had at least a couple who were conservative. One who was from the military, who was kind of my favorite character to write. But it was a very balanced show. It was politically oriented because it was about law, but you know, my political orientation would not have been clear from that first episode. And I guess that after a couple episodes, it would have started to come out, you know, the way that I did the plot line. But in any case, we went into development on it, and I decided, okay, I need to go get an agent. So I went out and started looking for an agent. And one of the first people that I went to was a guy named Larry Bexey. Larry is a major agent in town. Larry is he is actually a producer in the Valley of Elah, right? So that it tells you where he is politically. And so I kind of got hooked up with him. I had a meeting with him and a couple of his other agents because, you know, they figured, okay, he's from Harvard Law. Every year, there are three main kinds of shows in Hollywood, right? There's doctor shows, there's police shows, and there's lawyer shows. So here we have a guy from Harvard Law who can really write. You know, we'll for sure be able to get him on one of the legal shows, at least staffed as a writer. So I went and had a meeting with them. We were talking. I said to them, look, I have one goal and one goal only here, and that is I want to make you a lot of money. You know, as the agent, I want to make you a lot of money. I want to write a successful show, you know, all this kind of stuff. We finished the meeting. He says, that's the best meeting I've had in 10 years. You know, let's get started. So I start going back and forth with him on other scripts, trying to get staffed on a show. And about 3 weeks in, you know, I write a spec script of The Good Wife, which is what you do in Hollywood. You write a spec script of an existing show. They send it out to a bunch of different people. And then those people kind of respond to the spec script and say, you know, we're interested in speaking with him. So they sent it off to a bunch of different producers in town. One of the producers apparently called them and said to them, you know, this Shapiro kid, you know, I Googled him. I found his name. I will never work with anybody of that political persuasion. So, you know, I get a call back.
Do you know who that producer was? Or that's anonymous?
Unfortunately, they wouldn't tell me. But you know, I get a call back from the agent, from Larry. And, you know, Larry says, I'm not sure we can represent you. I said, well, you know, why is that? He says, well, you know, one of our lower level agents and our producer and this producer, you know, they Googled you. They found your political persuasion. And we're not sure you can ever get a job in this town with those politics. And of course, I said, you know, I don't understand why my politics is relevant to my ability to write. The reason he Googled me in the first place is because he thought my writing was good. And he said, well, you know, ideally that's not the way it should be, but unfortunately that's sort of the way it is. So what was amazing about that is that here I am writing a book on this topic. And, you know, when I went into this, when I went into this particular, you know, book, I really didn't think that there was as much discrimination in Hollywood against conservatives as people in Hollywood complain about. I always thought that it was really a lot of sour grapes, that people weren't getting jobs because they weren't that great at what they do. And then they were kind of pissing and moaning about it later. They thought, you know, this is, you know, they kind of figured this was kind of the typical discrimination complaint, right? You know, I'm not good enough to get the job, but I'm going to complain that it was discrimination that prevented me from getting the job. That's what I thought. And then it kind of happened to me after, you know, all of a month of trying to work in the industry. And then I started seeing it pop out everywhere. Right? I would interview people and they would say, yeah, sure, you know, I'm fine with discrimination against conservatives. I started interviewing liberals and asking them about it. And they'd admit, yeah, there's discrimination against conservatives in the industry. It happens all the time. And so it was kind of a fascinating transformation for me personally. And it became kind of a cause. And it's become a little bit of a cause celeb in town. I mean, we just got the Caucus for Producers, Writers, and Directors, which is a major Hollywood honor society, includes people like Tom Hanks. We got them to pass a unanimous resolution condemning political discrimination in the industry because of the revelations that I brought about in primetime propaganda. I mean, there were some mass resignations from the caucus because one of the top people there is Vin De Bono. So a lot of the people, the guy who said that he was fine with discrimination, so a lot of the people at the caucus, at least two or three of them, walked out and resigned. And that was a big shakeup for them and kind of freaked them out. And so they passed at first they refused to pass a resolution condemning political discrimination because they said, we are a nonpartisan group. How can we condemn discrimination?
Really, that's funny. It's kind of the point you make in the book about how if you substituted the word black or female or gay for conservative, these people in Hollywood would not only say it's horrific, and it is horrific to be discriminatory in any of those ways, but they would probably write a movie about how terrible these terrible people who discriminate against people without those other characteristics.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are the same people who whine and moan about, you know, so-called McCarthyism, when the truth is that there was an actual basis for some of the things McCarthy, he went overboard, obviously. There's a basis for a lot of the things McCarthy was actually saying. I mean, there were Soviet agents in Hollywood, and it's been documented at this point pretty well by Ann Coulter. But the fact is that, you know, they were really, you know, upset about that. Even though at the time, you know, Hollywood was very much in line with McCarthyism, they were making people sign loyalty oaths and stuff. But you know, then at the time and now, that is considered the darkest period of American history, right? That is the worst thing that ever happened. I mean, that's in Hollywood, they hate that more than they hate slavery. I mean, McCarthyism is really kind of where it's at in terms of the great evil. And then, of course, that's exactly what they're practicing on a political level, except they're not directing it against agents of a foreign state. They're directing it against more than half of the country who believe in traditional values.
Right, and you tell the story of Kelsey Grammer, who was TV's Frasier, who was forced to donate $10,000 to Barbara Boxer to stay in the business. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, Kelsey, you know, he's told this story a bunch of times. When he was a young actor, you know, he was on Cheers, I think. He was approached by one of the higher-ups at the show, and they said to him, you know, Kelsey, we're having a fundraiser for Barbara Boxer. He said, well, you know, I don't support Barbara Boxer. He said, Kelsey, we really think it would be good for you to support Barbara Boxer. And when they say that in Hollywood, what they really mean is, you know, it's either your brains or your signature on this piece of paper. He donated the money. There are a lot of people who are like that in Hollywood. This is one of the great lies that the left tells about right-wingers in Hollywood. They say, oh, you know, look at Kelsey Grammer. He works. Look at Patricia Heaton. She works. Well, no, I talked to Patricia, you know, I talked to Patty and about this book, and it was really fascinating. I talked to Patty late in the process, and I said to her, you know, Patty, have you ever been discriminated against in Hollywood based on your politics? Because she's pretty openly pro-life. You know, she's, you know, I'll get into her a little bit deeper in a moment, but the bottom line is that she said, no, I've never been discriminated against in Hollywood. I've never felt that. I said, that's okay. You know, that's great. You know, I want to write both sides. I want it to be that some people feel discriminated against, some people don't, because, you know, I don't want it to look one-sided. So, you know, great end of phone call. She calls back 2 days later. She says, Ben, I need to revise my statement. I called a bunch of people that I know in town because I was curious. I found out that I lost 6 specific jobs due to my political affiliation. And I said, okay, well, you know, I'll write that too. You know, I started to write that. She calls back a day later. She says, Ben, I'm afraid of the ramifications for my career if I appear in your book. Take me out. And so out of respect for her, I took her out. You know, she appears in the book in disguise. I call her an actor, right, which is now the gender-neutral term that's become, you know, famous in Hollywood. I, you know, I don't call her he, but I call her the actor, you know, all in one of the particular chapters. But that's Patty talking. And the reason I feel okay saying that is because, you know, 2 months ago she came out and revealed to, of all places, Radar Online, that she felt like she'd been discriminated against in her career. So it's no big secret at this point. But one thing that Patty did, which is the prerequisite for anyone working in Hollywood, it's true of Kelsey, it's true of Patty, it's true of Gary Sinise, it's true of everybody who is a big right-wing name working in Hollywood. The fact is that if you are anti-gay marriage, you will not work. Period. End of story. That is the bright line test right now. So Patty, you know, when she said she'd been discriminated against, she came out and she said, yeah, you know, I felt discrimination because I've been pro-life, but, you know, I'm not one of those right-wing kooks who's like anti-gay marriage or something. Well, I don't know what Patty's position is on gay marriage. You know, I wouldn't want to imply that I know that she's anti-gay marriage. I would say that My guess, and this is just, again, this is just a guess, this is just speculation. My guess is that she's a little bit more conflicted than that statement would imply. But the fact is that if you voted for Prop 8 in California, which is the measure that was designed to preserve traditional marriage, if you donated money to that effort, and if they find out about it, you'll never work again because you're like Bull Connor now.
Are there other bright line issues besides the gay marriage one? I mean, because are you saying that you could be a Reagan Republican and pro gay marriage and then you'll be fine?
No, you'll still feel a little bit, but that's the bright line test for working, not working. If you're a Reagan Republican, you'll work substantially less, right? I mean, so you can still work, maybe, but you have to be – but you know, it really won't work all that well. I mean, you can be – fiscally conservative is sometimes okay, although if you're anti-Obama, it's not really okay. Foreign policy conservative has become a lot more acceptable since Obama was elected because now, of course, we're still in Iraq. We're still in Afghanistan, so – now they can't really complain about us being in Iraq and Afghanistan, or at least they won't, because they're not ideologically honest. So, you know, during the Bush administration, if you were pro-Bush, that was a bright line test. During the Bush administration, if you were pro-war in Iraq, that was a bright line test. But the one that will continue to be the bright line test for the next 10 years is going to be gay marriage, because that's going to continue to be an ongoing issue in the country. And they will continue. I mean, you can see, if you watch their shows, you can see what their bright line issues are. That is right now by far the bright line issue, right? I don't know if you saw this poll, Tevi, but there was a poll that Gallup did about, I guess it was 6 weeks ago, where they polled Americans to see what percentage of Americans thought were gay, right? Well, what percentage of Americans people thought were gay? What they came up with was astonishing. 34% of Americans thought at least 25% of Americans were gay. Another 17% thought at least 20% of Americans were gay. Overall, 78% of Americans thought at least 10% of the population was gay. Now, statistically speaking, it's 2 to 5%, right? And it's probably closer to 2. So why is there this tremendously skewed view of the gay population in the United States? Well, the answer is pretty clear. If you watch the entertainment media, 20% of the population is gay. There's always a major gay character on every show. And that is something that Hollywood has promoted and something that they do consciously. And in fact, they will go back and insert gay characters for no apparent reason, you know, even if it's irrelevant to the plot. They'll just put a gay character in there to please GLAAD and to please the interest groups and to please, you know, all of their colleagues in Hollywood. So it's an issue for them that has become it really is a moral crusade for them. They feel this is their issue. This is the one they're going to push above all others. And obviously, you know, there are certain shows that spearhead that effort, including Glee.
One guy you mentioned and whom Andrew Breitbart has also mentioned is Dwight Schultz, who just didn't want to put up with this. And he just is as outspoken a conservative as I guess you'll find. And he, I guess, doesn't work as much or just kind of opted out of Hollywood. Can you talk a little bit about him and his perspective on things?
Yeah, Dwight
and is also.
Yeah, Dwight was the star of the A-Team. He was howling Mad Murdoch on the A-Team. He also starred in a movie called Fat Man, Little Boy with Paul Newman, which was about the making of the atomic bomb. He played Oppenheimer. In the early 80s, he was a very big star. He had a couple run-ins that made it pretty clear to people in Hollywood who was conservative. He started to lose work very, very rapidly. And by the end of the 80s, his career was basically over in Hollywood. You know, he still works. He does voiceovers. He won't appear, you know, they won't let him appear on screen for the most part. But he voiced over, you know, a lot of characters. Basically, you know, I sat down with Dwight, and Dwight had become a friend. And Dwight is, you know, he's very outspokenly conservative. I mean, he subs for Michael Savage sometimes on the radio, right? He's very outspokenly conservative. And a lot of the cast of the A-Team was conservative, by the way. And, you know, basically...
Wait, Mr. T?
I don't know about Mr. T. You know, Dirk Benedict was conservative. But Mr.
He was in space, right?
Yeah. So I'm not sure about Mr. T, but you know, I know that.
What about Hannibal?
I'd have to. You know what? Well, I'll have to ask Dwight and get back to you on that one. I'll find out.
Wait, we can't tell anymore, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'll have to ask Dwight, you know, about it, and I'll get him to give you a call and let you know. But Dwight is, you know, so basically what happened with Dwight is a couple things. One, he had a run-in with he was trying to be cast in the Howie Mandel part on St. Elsewhere. You know, the kind of crazy doctor. And he came in and he was already a star at that point. They brought him in for the casting session, and Bruce Paltrow, he had a run-in with Bruce Paltrow, who was the producer of the show and Gwyneth's dad, a little bit earlier. Like, Bruce had found out that he was a Reagan Republican. He walks in and Bruce says to him, "Oh my God, you're that Reagan a-hole." Right. And then as he walked out of the room, he said, "No Reagan a-hole will work on this show." And that kind of started things in motion for Dwight. And over time, he became less and less kind of willing to deal with the BS in Hollywood, the kind of covering up, the kissing butt. And he started to lose a lot of work as a result of it. And that's not rare. I mean, the people who do work in Hollywood right now, you know, people like Adam Baldwin, who's, if you read his Twitter feed, it's clear he's conservative. And Adam, you know, is another friend. Adam, you know, feels that he hasn't been discriminated against, but that's because Adam only came out as conservative in the last, like, 2-3 years. I mean, the vast majority of Hollywood actors who are successful and conservative, they started off as liberals, or they started off in the closet. They stayed there for 10 to 15 years, and then finally they kind of slowly came out of the closet to people who they knew. And at that point, people there's sort of an assumption in Hollywood that if you're conservative, you are an ogre. You must be a bad person. You must be nasty and mean and just a jerk. And so if you spend 10 to 15 years convincing people that you're not a jerk, when you come out as a conservative, then they kind of look askance at you. It's still not something that's good, but they'll at least kind of say, okay, well, you overcame the presumption that you're a jerk because I've known you for so long. And that is, you know, that's why it's such a lie when they say, oh, Jerry Bruckheimer, you know, he's conservative and he's worked. John Belisario, he's conservative. He works. You know, well, yes, you can point to people who work. The question is, were any of these people open conservatives when they started in the industry? And the answer is obviously no. None of them were. And that really is the key. I mean, they all kind of infiltrated or converted along the way, you know, David Mamet style.
You know, you said your book's not really about content analysis, and it isn't, but you do some content analysis in terms of you look at certain comedies and how they have a left-wing perspective and some dramas and how they have a left-wing perspective. One problem I've always had with the content analysis approach is that people on the other side always find counterexamples. So you could say, well, you know, certain shows are liberal, but at the same time, they will say, well, you know, the sun still sets in the west and the good guys win, and you know, these things are really inherently conservative. Also, you in your appendix list 12 conservative shows. So, I mean, how do you kind of prove that overall there's a liberal agenda coming out on screen when there are all these counterexamples?
You know, the truth is there are really only a few counterexamples, and even the ones that I mentioned in the conservative shows at the end of the book, there are really only, I think, 3 of those that were made by people who are libertarian / conservative. And I interviewed a lot of the people who made the other shows, and they're very clearly liberal, and they did want to get liberal messages out. So, you know, I call Lost a conservative show. And that's because, I have to admit, that is probably my own bias coming out just because I love that show, and I think it's a brilliant show. You know, I think that it has elements of spirituality that you wouldn't be able to get on network television if it weren't a sci-fi show. But the people who made it, Darren, you know, what's his name, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. And, you know, I spoke with Carlton Cuse, and when I walked in the office, every single person in the office was wearing a shirt. I talk about it in the book, was wearing a shirt that had the Dharma symbol on the shirt replaced with an Obama symbol in the center.
Right, and this is that sort of spider web with the word Dharma in the middle.
Right, exactly. And so it's the Dharma symbol, but they just replaced it with the word Obama. And Damon Lindelof had handed those out to the entire cast and crew in the middle of Obama's run. And, you know, the same thing is true of The Cosby Show, which I think I ranked as, like, number 2 on the conservative list. And if you look at The Cosby Show, it's a pretty conservative show. Part of that is because Bill Cosby is relatively conservative for who he is until he endorsed Obama anyway. But the people who made the show, Marcy Carsey and Tom Warner, are about as liberal as possible to get. They thought they were doing something kind of paternalistically liberal. When they did The Cosby Show, they were teaching black people that it's okay to be a doctor, kind of. Even the show...
Well, there's a conservative element to that message as well, right? I mean,
correct.
Conservatives have long talked about the rise of the black middle class.
Exactly. That's why that's kind of why I labeled it a conservative show. I think they didn't intend for it to be a conservative show. I think they intended it to be kind of a liberal show. But it came out as conservative because at the time, it was the only kind of normal family on TV with a traditional family structure where mom and dad had authority, where the kids were not considered. I mean, the first episode of the show, you know, the son, Theo, he's talking to Bill, and he says, I don't want to go to college. And he gives this whole speech about how, you know, I really don't want to go to college. It's not who I am. It's not my passion. It's not what I'm all about. I just want to go travel the world, right? And in the 1970s, that would have been the final word. Everyone would have clapped. Everyone would have cheered. Oh, look at this young man standing up for himself and not falling in line with the kind of compliant society. And in the first episode of the show, in the pilot, Bill turns to him and says, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You know, and then he lectures him about why he needs to go to college.
Was there a laugh track on that line?
I would imagine so. I think there was. And the bottom line is that, you know, it was a conservative show partially because of Bill Cosby, but, you know, also because it was a traditional family structure. Now, the reason they could get away with the traditional family structure in Cosby Show and make it a pretty conservative show is because it was about a black family. If it's about a white family, it never makes the air. So it wasn't meant to be a conservative show. You know, the same thing is true of the Waltons. It was meant to be a response to All in the Family, saying that America is a good place, not a nasty, venal place. But by the same token, it was meant to be an ode to FDR. And if you watch the Waltons with that in mind, you'll see that all over the place. It's an ode to FDR. They're constantly talking about, you know, the Works Progress Administration. They're constantly talking about the TVA, and all these things are just absolutely wonderful and glorious. And even though nobody from the Waltons is really benefiting from those measures, right? They're supporting themselves. None of them are taking government checks. they are, you know, listening to FDR's fireside chats on the radio and talking about how, you know, wonderful he is all the time. So it's, none of these shows were meant to be conservative in terms of, you know, they can always find counterexamples. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do say at the beginning of the book, look, this isn't the Encyclopedia of Television, right? If you want to read about every show in TV history, there's a book called The Encyclopedia of Television. It's about 3,000 pages long, and it lists every show that's ever been made. But if you just want to look at the top-ranked shows since 1970, you can find maybe five shows that are really conservative. Like, outwardly, you know, out and out, you can say with full conviction these have conservative values. And every other show is either apolitical or liberal. And this is excluding reality TV. I'm talking about scripted.
You have 12 in your appendix that are conservative shows. I guess some of those,
a lot of those are
unintentionally conservative, right?
Yeah, and a lot of those are pre-1970, right? I mean, I list Gunsmoke. I list Father Knows Best. I list a bunch of ones that are pre-1970, that are older shows. And Dragnet, which was pre-1970. And the ones that are newer shows, again, Lost is not really a conservative show. And I put it in there because I think that it got certain values across that I like, but by any stretch of the imagination, it's more of an apolitical show than it is a political show. 24 is, the truth is, even 24, which, you know, conservatives like me love, you know, I love 24. The first four seasons were great. It started to jump the shark season five, and by season six, it jumped the shark. So, you know, there's another shark behind that other shark, and it had eaten up Fonzie's, you know, jet ski. But it's the 24 was never a socially conservative show, right? It was a foreign policy conservative show. And even then, it wasn't as conservative as I think a lot of people thought it was, meaning it was Jack Bauer running around torturing people, you know, Liam Neeson style and Taken. But President Palmer is by no means a conservative, right? I mean, President Palmer is supposed to be a Democrat president. And I mean, from a conservative perspective, President Palmer is kind of a pansy. I mean, he's constantly, you know, trying to throw obstacles in front of Jack, and he's seen as the hero. He's kind of the good guy. Jack's a good guy. President Palmer's a good guy. They just have kind of these honest disagreements. And from the conservative perspective, President Palmer really ought to be telling Jack, you go do what you need to do, and I'll deal with the political ramifications. And instead, it turns into kind of Palmer having all these, you know, agonizing moments over, you know, should Jack torture X terrorist in order to get X, you know, in order to get Y information. Even 24 has its liberal moments, and beyond which, it's certainly not a socially conservative show. I mean, you know, if you look at it's typical Fox. Let's put it that way. You know, Fox Network is very heavily sexualized, maybe more so than the other networks. And I've talked to the heads of Fox, and I talked to Sandy Grusho, who used to run Fox. And it's a very heavily sexed up network. I mean, it does put shows like Glee on there. Fox is not Fox News.
Are the executives at Fox any more conservative than execs at other stations, given the Murdoch ownership of Fox?
No. At Fox News, they are, because it's run by Roger Ailes, obviously. But at Fox itself, absolutely not. In fact, most of them are people who staffed other networks and were brought in to staff Fox.
Are they criticized for working for Murdoch?
Yeah. I mean, look, everybody is criticized for working for Murdoch. I think people in the industry kind of yes and no. I mean, I think that they're criticized for working for Murdoch because this is seen as you know, Murdoch is seen as the great evil in the world with his tentacles stretching. I mean, they see Murdoch the same way we see George Soros. But you know, I think that the problem is that the other issue that they have is they kind of see these people as the intrepid explorers into new territory, right? They're going over to Fox and they're dealing with the evil Rupert Murdoch corporate empire and being able to put shows like Glee on the air, right? And Glee is right now their very, very favorite show. They love the show Glee, which I think is – I don't call for boycotts in the book. I really don't. I say it over and over. Yeah, I'm not telling you to stop watching TV. TV's great. TV's fun. TV's wonderful. There's one show that I think people absolutely should turn off, and that's Glee. I think Glee is an egregious example of what Hollywood can do. It's Hollywood flexing its muscle and getting away with it. And it is absolutely – it's a disgusting show because it's not even on – most Hollywood shows – are honest enough to aim at adults. Glee is High School Musical with Nip Tuck mentality. It's made by the guys who. It's astonishing to me that this show was, you know, ever greenlit. You know, from a values perspective, I'm never really astonished by what Hollywood does because they'll do anything for a buck except put, you know, solid conservatism on television. But what is astonishing to me is they would take the guy Ryan Murphy who made Nip Tuck, which is one of the more, you know, kind of greasy and sleazy shows in the history of television. I don't know if you've ever seen an episode of it on FX. They show reruns, but it is really gross. And take that guy and say to him, you know what? You know, it's fine with us if you write a High School Musical show. I mean, that is it. Really is the equivalent of taking someone like Gore Vidal and saying, we want you to write kids' TV now, right? it's not exactly the world's best idea. And by episode three or four, it was coming out pretty clearly what Glee was all about, and it was all about pushing Ryan Murphy's gay agenda. He said it himself. He said that he wants to, you know, push the gay marriage agenda, and it's more than that. It's you know, if you want to do that on network TV, that's become acceptable. But he goes further than that. He puts all the shock value junk on there just for the sake of putting the shock value on there. So, you know, he'll put two 15-year-old cheerleaders making out with each other, right? Why? Does that, you know, contribute anything to the national debate? No. It's just that he wants to make – he said it himself. He wants to desensitize us to certain images that they can get away with anything. And, you know, what Hollywood has been at the very – if you want to see the impact of Hollywood, I think the gay movement is the clearest place that you can see it. It's very obvious what they've done. I mentioned the statistics in terms of, you know, how many Americans, most Americans think are gay. But it's a very sophisticated strategy. It's a really good kind of like crystallized – perfect marble case example of how Hollywood impacts people's opinions, and they've really led us by the nose all the way to where we are now. There's no question about it.
I will have to tell my wife this about Glee because she watches it, although I do not. But I want to talk a little bit about what you were getting at when you said markets, and you've been very generous with your time. I'll make that the last question before we get into our final signature question. But in terms of markets, Michael Medved famously wrote in his book Hollywood vs. America, which is a very interesting and very readable book. He said that markets really aren't determining what Hollywood does. They may claim that they're doing it based on the market, but if they really were doing that, they'd make a lot more G movies and a lot fewer R movies, looking at the numbers of which movies are successful. Is there a market element to what goes on TV in Hollywood?
And there's always a market element, and Michael's right, sort of, and he's kind of wrong a little bit, which is that, yes, everyone knows G movies make more money. They also cost more money. So it costs you, you know, the average budget on a G-rated flick is going to be $50 million or above. The average budget on an R-rated flick is going to be about 10 or 20. So it's a lot cheaper to make R-rated films. And yes, G-rated films tend to make a lot more money, but again, they're really, really expensive. So that's one of the things that dictates movies. And TV theoretically should be more responsive than the movie industry because you have ratings, right? The ratings come in every night. So those should be determining what's on TV. But there is a market disconnect in TV that does not exist in the movies. In the movies, how do movies make their money? They make their money because you go to the theater, you plunk down $12.50, and you get in, right? I mean, and so they're making their money off you direct. In TV, the viewer is nothing more than really just a measurement. The viewer is not all that important because you're not paying anybody. You know, when your wife watches Glee, she's not paying Glee, right? Glee is not making money directly off of her. The way that they monetize her is they look at her and they say, okay, she's a viewer. We can go sell her eyeballs to advertisers who want to, you know, get their message across. And so what that's left is kind of wiggle room in the marketplace because it's not an exact science. I talk about the Nielsens a fair bit in the book. The Nielsens are not an exact science by any stretch of the imagination. Plus, there's this major scam that's been going on in Hollywood, and it is absolutely a scam that people who are aged 18 to 34 and 18 to 49 are worth more than people who are aged 50 and above in terms of consumers. There is no evidence to show that. In fact, right now, there's a lot of evidence to show exactly the contrary, because who has disposable income in this country? You know, who has savings in this country? Who has the ability to spend money, disposable income in this country? It's not people who are under 50. All those people are, a lot of them are now unemployed. The younger you are in this country, the better chance you're unemployed. If you're 18 to 34, your unemployment rate is significantly higher than the general population. You have no savings and you have no disposable income. So
it's seniors, more Matlock.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, CBS, and the proof is in the pudding. If you look at the most obvious disconnect here is, what is the number one earning network? What network earns the most money? CBS earns the most money. Nobody under the age of 50 has ever seen a CBS show, ever. Nobody watches CBS if you're under the age of 50, right?
I don't.
Right, exactly. I mean, what shows do you watch? You probably watch House. You probably watch Glee. You probably watch some of the stuff on ABC. You may watch The Office. You may watch Parks and Rec. You're gonna watch all of the typical younger people shows, right? So CBS is the number one earning network. It earns the most. Now you take a show like The Good Wife on CBS, which is one of their bigger hits. And last season, it was ranked, I think, number 11 overall or 12 overall in all of the shows that were broadcast in primetime last year. You take a show like Glee, which is ranked number 33 overall in its first season. And Glee was averaging $47 from advertisers, $47 per 1,000 viewers. The Good Wife is averaging half of that. Now, how is it that The Good Wife can be averaging so much less than Glee? And the answer is because the advertisers have this weird idea that the viewers of Glee are worth more than the viewers of The Good Wife. The young viewers are worth more than older viewers. And they're absolutely not. I talk about it at length. In fact, the Nielsens, after I wrote the book, about a month before the book came out, when it was too late to, you know, add this, the Nielsens came out with a study that showed exactly what I'm saying. That showed exactly that there was zero correlation, zero, between age and value as a consumer to the advertiser. And yet the entire industry is built around this. And what does that mean in practical terms? What that means is, what is the most liberal age group in the country? 18 to 34. So you're always appealing to that kind of cutting edge, social liberal, urban demographic. And what you end up with is very liberal TV. And the way they justify it in the marketplace is by saying, well, at least we're targeting the people who matter. Well, no, you're really not. You're really skewing this. It's the same thing as when CNN does a poll and they poll 60% of Democrats and 40% of Republicans. And then bam, you know, look, President Obama has a 61% approval rating, right? I mean, you're skewing the poll. Well, that's what they're doing with the market data. They're skewing the market data. So they're saying, yeah, we make a lot of money. Yeah, you know, look at all our young viewers because those are the ones that matter. Well, no, they're not. The viewers that matter are all of the viewers. And you're leaving a huge chunk of viewership on the table. And that's why, you know, nobody seems to be able to understand why Hollywood isn't making more conservative programming. And Hollywood says, look, we're just money driven. You know, that's all we're about. I went and I talked to the executives. They're not just money driven. You can have more than one goal. It's so funny. I was interviewed by, you know, I get interviewed by people who are on the left. And kind of say, you know, Hollywood's just about making money. You know, that's all they're really interested in. They're just like everybody else. They're just like making money. Well, number one, you know, it's really funny because these are the same liberals who criticize corporations for just wanting to make money. But when Hollywood does it, then it's an excuse for what they do. But, you know, beyond that, you know, liberals will say that Hollywood just wants to make money. You can have more than one goal. You know, you can make money and be liberal. That's more fun to them. It's more fulfilling than it is to make money just for the sake of making money. And that's especially true when you're talking about a bunch of socialists who are very rich. And that's really what Hollywood is. It's a bunch of people who in their own brains are socialists, but who live in these massive mansions. I mean, I interviewed them at their houses. They're gorgeous. You know, these massive mansions off of Sunset Boulevard, you know, up in Mandeville Canyon Road. Those houses are big. And these people have to somehow justify to themselves why they get to make so much money and everybody else in America is so poor. And what they do is they say to themselves, okay, well, at least we are, you know, standing up for social justice values. We're standing up for the little guys. So sure, you know, I don't give any charity, and sure, I make a lot of money. But, you know, at least I'm standing up for higher taxes, right, in my shows. At least I'm trying to convince the American public to move more in the direction of income equality. So they're giant hypocrites. I mean, they're limousine liberals, and it really pervades the society.
Well, it's a really interesting book, and it's been a very interesting interview. I'd like to close with our signature question here on New Books in Public Policy, which is, based on what you've learned doing the book, if you were czar for a day, what policies would you propose and try and put into place to solve some of the problems you're talking about in the book?
You know, I'm always against government regulation. The only government regulation that I would, you know, propose is better enforcement of FCC law. I do believe that, you know, if you're watching, I think egregiously sexual material should not be on television. I've been consistent in that view. I don't think the FCC should sit idly by while, you know, graphic sex appears on network TV, and it's getting more and more graphic. So that's the only government regulation I'd pursue in terms of, I should say a couple more things on that. You know, that cut off the tax subsidies for Hollywood. So again, they're giant hypocrites. They take lots of tax subsidies and they take lots of cash from Washington, D.C. and from state and local government. I'd abolish that. I don't like special privileges for anybody. Everybody should be competing on the same playing field. I think they should lower taxes for everybody, including for Hollywood, but I don't think they should be getting special magical benefits. If I were God, not czar, I would change the minds of the advertisers and convince them that what they're doing is stupid and wrong. But the truth is, I think most of the measures that I propose at the end of the book are ones that can be implemented right away if conservatives get their heads out of their butts. And I think it's really not that difficult. We have a lot of money. We need to start dedicating it to entertainment and culture. We need to stop worrying about the local dog catcher race, because guess what? It's just a dog catcher. And we need to donate that money instead to making great film, great TV. And we need to be more subtle. Conservatives, you know, we tend to go after issues with basically a sledgehammer, when a scalpel would do more. We are right now where liberals were in like 1970. Right, the liberals in 1970, when they finally gained control of TV, which happened in 1970-71, when they finally gained total control. If you watch the shows that they made, those shows are not very good. I'm talking about All in the Family in particular. If you watch All in the Family right now, it is the most dated show. It's not funny. It's not amusing. It's not well written. It's just annoying, and it's grating. But they finally got control of the vehicle, and they said, okay, we're going to go for broke. Right, we're going to take this entertainment vehicle, and we are going to shove down Americans' throats what we think of conservatives. I think conservatives in entertainment have been doing the same thing, except they're not nearly as well funded. So if you watch, you know, the kind of stuff that conservatives have been making, conservatives need to be, and again, it goes back to the point I was making at the very beginning of the interview. Conservatives need to be honest about what they want to watch. You know, when we put on our conservative hat, I tend to think of people, when it comes to entertainment, people are like dolphins. They're two separate sides of our brain. You know, there's the entertainment side and there's the political side. When the political side is on, the entertainment side is off. When the entertainment side is on, the political side is off. And so, unfortunately, most conservatives, when you ask them what they watch, the political side goes on and they lie. And they say, no, what I'm watching at night is C-SPAN. What I'm watching at night is Fox News. What I'm watching at night, and when I go to see a movie, what I'm interested in watching is family-friendly fare. And then when they're actually ready to watch TV and they turn the political side of their brain off, what movie do they go see? They go see Avatar, right, just like everybody else. And so we need to understand that what liberals figured out very quickly, which is if we want to make a difference in this debate, we can't be so damn obvious about our politics. We need to make good entertainment that people actually want to watch and that has the right values, not entertainment that is centered around the values and then shoves it down people's throats. You know, it's better to don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Right? I mean, just because you want to make a point to your friends that you are, you know, religious or that you are conservative doesn't mean every movie has to be Fireproof or every movie has to be an American Carol. It's much better to make a movie like The Dark Knight, which is not openly conservative, but which is a very conservative movie if you read just slightly under the surface.
Ben Shapiro, I don't watch any of the shows that you predicted I watched earlier except perhaps The Office, but if you do come up with a show, I would be very interested in watching it. You're the author of Primetime Propaganda, and we appreciate having you on New Books in Public Policy.
Terrific. Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Ben Shapiro, author of Primetime Propaganda. The book is a real object lesson in why you shouldn't assume anything about people who come to talk to you. Because the people interviewed in the book would not have said the things they said, the damaging things they said about their political ideology and how they put it on TV, without their assuming that Ben Shapiro shared their political perspectives. It is also another object lesson, one that I end the show with every week. And if you really want to learn stuff, perhaps it's time to turn off the TV and do what I suggest every week. Keep reading. This is Tevi Troy for New Books in Public Policy.